with living with the West or the East, with synthesis, and we will borrow, because everything in a sense is there for to cherish and to enjoy it in other cultures and civilizations. That modernist position is further weakened because of the failure after 9/11 of the Muslim governments to create any genuine sense of participation of their own people, so that the local people see the post 9/11 events as something that further reinforces the tyranny of their rulers. So that second position becomes, as far as the vast majority of Muslims are concerned, becomes very much weakened. And you see the emergence of many military dictators, in fact, actively supported by the West after 9/11. Before 9/11, they were there, they were under pressure from the West, but after 9/11, they suddenly find that these are convenient allies. Now, Pakistan is a very good example. The third position, of course, is that of the fundamentalist literalist. And that position, to my mind, in the last 50 to 60 years, was always the marginal one. It was never the central one in the Muslim world. It was always under pressure. And we saw, I growing up in Pakistan in the 50s and 60s, saw the modernist position as the dominant one. That was the narrative of the founding father of Pakistan, Mr. Jinnah. And I always found that the literalist, fundamentalist, very marginal, out of touch with the times. And I really felt that their time had passed, that they would not ever get center stage. But after 9/11, I found that a lot of sympathy was created among ordinary people for this third position. And this is the reason why. As I traveled in the Muslim world, and as I talked to people and I asked them, what is going on, how do you feel about the world, they would say, we believe, and this was Dr. Beck right throughout the Muslim world. And I remember that I went with my American students, we conducted questionnaires, interviews, and we talked to presidents and students and taxi drivers, the whole spectrum of society. We went to madrasas and mosques and universities. And we went to the Middle East, South Asia, Far East Asia. And this is what Muslims would say in answer to the question, what is the number one problem? They would say, we believe that Islam is under attack. We believe that Islam is under attack, and it is being spearheaded by one nation in the West, and that is the United States. And therefore, we also felt and saw and heard fairly high degrees of anti-Americanism. So that before we arrived in Karachi, the Marriott Hotel was blown up. Just 10 yards from the Marriott, the American embassy was attacked, and an American counselor died just before we arrived to stay in the Marriott. And this happened throughout the journey. Now, what this did was this, that when we talked to ordinary Muslims, whether in Karachi or whether in Kuala Lumpur, they would say, look, if there's a crisis in your home is being attacked. You see what's happening in Iraq, in Afghanistan, all this chaos that's taking place within the Muslim world. We don't get justice. We don't have access to our own traditions. Our own faith is being undermined. And then in that situation, if a man comes along and talks of mysticism and love and compassion, few people will respond to him. Similarly, if a man comes along and talks of writing a letter to the Times or appealing for sense or having a series of meetings, there will not be many people who will respond, perhaps some westernized or some urbanized, educated Muslim. But if a man comes along and responds in emotion and says, you are being attacked and I will defend you, it will be something that will evoke a response, because there is anger and there is a response in anger. So the response comes on the basis of emotion and heart, not on the basis of intelligence or rationality. And that, of course, as you know, Dr. Beck, is very much away from the Islamic tradition, which is always based in sense and balance and compassion. So therefore, I find, in answer to your question and linking up with the day after 9/11, that had the United States, had President Bush come on television and said, we have been struck, we are going through this terrible, terrible traumatic phase of our history. It's a very testing time. But as an American, as a person who believes in the founding fathers, I will always remember what Benjamin Franklin said, that what is begun in anger ends in shame. I will ensure that the spirit of the founding fathers that informs us today and guides us, that will prevail in my response. We will go out there and get the people who attacked us. We will do so with our friends, with our allies who are living in the Muslim world, friends in Pakistan, friends in Afghanistan, friends in Iraq, and so on. And I will appeal to you to help me in this endeavor, because we will ensure that this never happens again to the United States. Now, he could say, I'm also taking this opportunity of guaranteeing to you that if you are prepared to come with me on the road to democracy, prepared to come along in terms of human rights and civil liberties, I will underscore and guarantee that for you and underwrite it for you. And if he were to then move into the Muslim world vigorously, strongly, through his economic aid, through the army, through the diplomats, and begin to implement democracy, it would have changed the entire mood and the bulk, the masses of the Muslim world, into a violently pro-American mass of people. Because most Muslims would have loved to have some education, some schools, some colleges, and a chance to participate in society, to participate in the processes of democracy. Now, in fact, what happened was quite the reverse. So that what happened was that in most Muslim societies, the ordinary people heard about democracy, they heard about human rights, they heard about civil liberties, but the reality was they knew interrogation camps, they knew of these secret prison camps, they knew of these dreadful terrorist laws which could pick up anyone. A neighbor could complain against you and you were simply picked up because you didn't get on with the neighbor. This has been happening throughout the Muslim world. There are too many cases to even doubt them. So the result was that in the end, after billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars, thousands and thousands of lives, several thousand American lives and maybe over a million Muslim lives, we have ended up with the gap between the United States and the Muslim world, that gap far wider than it was several years ago. And this is the Pew survey published, as you know, Dr. Beck, a couple of weeks ago. So that the gap that exists between the West, America and the Muslim world is wider than ever before. And therefore your exercise to say, okay, what could have been the next day, and perhaps to ask yourself, Dr. Beck, look a bit into the future, what the new president of the United States needs to do on the day he takes office so that he can correct this particular course and trajectory of history.
Yeah, let's stay with that new president. Are you getting any signals from people you know in Pakistan or the Muslim world about our presidential choice?
Dr. Beck, could you speak up a bit? The line is not too clear.
Are you picking up from your Muslim friends outside this country any particular choice they would make between a Clinton or a McCain or a Obama?
That's an interesting question. You would assume there'd be a pattern. The way I'm seeing it is that Muslims tend to vote very much in terms of the individual rather than the party. For example, one of the most popular presidents in Pakistan would have been Ronald Reagan. You remember in the 1980s, the image of Reagan standing at the White House receiving the Afghan freedom fighters and calling them freedom fighters and respecting them became an iconic image. It was flashed throughout the Muslim world. So similarly, they believe that, especially the governments, that perhaps someone like McCain would be a strong ally. I think President Musharraf may be more inclined to go along with someone like McCain. A lot of ordinary people may be curious, interested, even sympathetic to someone like Obama. They may believe what 30% of Americans believe, that he's a secret Muslim. Many of them support Hillary Clinton because Bill Clinton remains a popular figure in some parts of the Muslim world. So I would say it's more like this rather than a question of Republican or Democrat for Muslims.
Okay.
And by the way, that also holds for the United States itself. In the last election, the previous election, the 2000 election, the vast majority of Muslims actually supported Bush. And then after that, they sort of pulled back. There was some confusion. And right now you have a kind of division support for the parties.
The other question I want to ask, and I'm sure Elsa has some too, about Al-Qaeda, and since you're from Pakistan and are very close to those dynamics, is Al-Qaeda getting weaker or stronger?
I look at it slightly differently, Dr. Beck. I have been an administrator in charge of parts of Balochistan and in charge of Waziristan, so I have some idea of how it really works. I wouldn't put it in terms of Al-Qaeda or one group or the other group. I would look at the mass of the tribe in which is situated the Al-Qaeda. I would then ask, is the support for the Al-Qaeda improving, increasing, or decreasing? And I would say right now, the Al-Qaeda or Taliban or whatever you like to call them have never been stronger. The tribal areas of Pakistan, which was inaccessible and off limits to everyone in history, has never ever been dominated by the religious clerics, who we call the Taliban. Today, the religious clerics are totally dominating the tribal areas. They are beheading anyone who seems to be pro-government. They are banning girls from going to school. They are fining and punishing any man caught without a beard. This is unprecedented in the tribal areas where, as you know, there have been tribal chiefs, there have been powerful warlords, there have been government agents who have also been influential sources of authority. All of them today are sidelined as the Taliban have emerged.
Why is that happening?
Very simple. It has been a complete collapse of the modernist position of Muslim authority. So while government has not been able to give them any security, any credibility, any proper development schemes, it has simply met their demand, that is the tribal peoples along the borders, with force or then withdrawal and appeasement. And the tribal peoples are very conscious of political games. They should have been dealt with very differently, with either a clear-cut policy of authority as in the past, or then brutal force. Either could have perhaps worked. But this business of going in there one day, losing hundreds of men, withdrawing the next day, and pouring dollars into the tribal areas, has shown the tribal areas that government in Pakistan is weak, vacillating, and undecided. So the result is that the influence of the Taliban has increased exponentially, and today the Taliban, forget the tribal areas, they are now holding sway in Swat. Now Swat, Dr. Beck, you may or may not know, is one of the most famous tourist attractions in Asia. It's a beautiful place, very much like Switzerland up in North Pakistan. It's in the settled areas, not tribal areas. And for the first time in history, the greatest tourist attraction area of Pakistan is overrun by the Taliban. And the schools, the girls' schools of that place, which were the pride of the Wali of Swat, the ruler of Swat, who happened to be my wife's grandfather, he had his greatest pride and joy was this series of girls' schools that he had created. Those girls' schools have been closed by the Taliban. They have blown up the statues, the Buddha statues, and they are imposing fines on anyone who they feel is against Islam. Now, this is happening in Swat. Forget the tribal area. So I would say it's been, unfortunately, downhill all the way.
Dr. Ahmed, some people make a distinction between, in the Muslim world, between the close enemy and the far enemy. The close enemy being the government for these extremist groups, and the far enemy is the West. And the only way to gain support among their tribes is to attack the far enemy. But the real reason is because these, don't you think, because it's been festering under the surface?
That's a good observation, because very often many of these people have been living according to their own customs, according to their own traditions, and there's been a modus vivendi between the government, local government, and these groups, the tribal social rural groups of places, as in Pakistan, Afghanistan, that whole region. But today what you have is a loss of credibility for the government, which is your what you would call the near enemy, and then the far enemy. The people see their this local government being supported by the Americans. And what saddens me very much, and I want to put this on record, is that the United States has been very generous with Pakistan. The United States has given Pakistan, as it has given Egypt and Jordan and all its allies, a lot of money, which is coming out of the pockets of all of us. Pakistan has got something like $17 billion since 9/11. When you look at the breakup of this money, the vast, vast proportion of this money has gone into buying helicopter gunships and missiles and tanks for the Pakistan army. And this has been used not so much to fight Al-Qaeda and so on, but it has been used primarily against tribal people in Balochistan, in the frontier province, and the local people have again and again complained in parliament. They have said, why are Americans killing us? Why are they our enemies? And I find this a paradox, because America has done this as an act of friendship, because they're wanting to help Pakistan. So this huge investment is simply creating a counter effect to what it was intended to do. I would say, going back to Dr. Beck's question, on the 12th of September, President Bush should have said, I will continue to give aid to my friends and allies. I respect the peoples there. But my aid will be now entirely educational. I'm going to help you with your colleges, with your schools, with your teachers' training programs, with your syllabi. I will send you my best teachers, and I'll bring your best teachers over here so that I help you and the direction with which you can move forward to fulfill your own destiny as good Islamic populations, so we can live in peace and friendship and compassion.
So with the rise of Al-Qaeda now, since 9/11 until now, before 9/11 they had, as you well know, just two websites, and now they have more than 4,000 websites on the net. And if we go a little bit to the Near East, where we can see Hezbollah and Hamas and Ikhwan Muslimin, what do you expect? Take us a little bit in the future. Where do you see it going?
I see it very clearly. Look, go back to my models. I'm a scholar, so I see things in terms of analytical models. You have three models which are now, three of them are in play. They are sort of swinging one way or the other way in relation to each other. And the third model, the literalist, fundamentalist model, is on the upswing. These are not permanent. These swing around, they move around, they're not static. And if America continues its policies, that third model will continue to draw strength and continue to grow. And what it will do is it will damage the modernist position and block the mystic position. So therefore, it will become the main spokesperson or representation of Islam. And you saw how it works in the real world, to the point where Benazir Bhutto, the most popular politician, the ruler, the head of the PPP, the largest party in Pakistan, was actually blown up in Pakistan. She represents modernist Islam. So therefore you have a situation where there is a threat, where the other forces of Islam are in fact battling for the future. And in the future, once again I repeat, if we aren't able to shape any dialogue or agenda after the new president takes over, the third model will continue to rise and perhaps even dominate the scene in the Muslim world. Think of a scenario where that model takes over Pakistan, a country with 165 million people, a country that is nuclear, a country that is in such a strategic situation that if you pull out your maps and have a look at it, you will see that Afghanistan, the Afghanistan position for the American alliance will collapse in 24 hours without Pakistan. And have a look at the map again, and you'll see that Pakistan shares a border of hundreds of miles with Iran and with China. And you'll suddenly realize that if the United States loses a country like Pakistan, it would have created a huge logistical and geopolitical nightmare for itself. So these are things I hope the new president of the United States will be thinking of now.
Absolutely. You give great data in your books, especially about how many Muslims are in the world and how few are in the Arab world. If you want to give these numbers, but the second question is, where do you see the role of Saudi Arabia and the responsibility that the head of where Mecca exists, the responsibility of such a country towards Muslims?
Very good questions. The first most important question to answer is the Muslim world. Now, in America, because few people knew much about Islam before 9/11, after 9/11, people assumed that Arab equals the Muslim world. Now, of course, we all know, and I think people know now in the United States, that the Arabs are a very important part of the Muslim world. The reason is that the Quran, the holy book of the Muslims, was revealed in Arabic. The reason is that the Prophet of Islam was an Arab. The reason is that the two holiest cities in the Muslim world, Makkah and Medina, are in the Arab world. But having said that, we have to be conscious that the Arabs are only 18% of the Muslim world. And in some senses, the action has shifted outside the Middle East. So today you have, I've been talking about Pakistan, Afghanistan, you have a very, very interesting situation in that part of the world. In fact, I believe something like one-third of the Muslim world is in South Asia. So once again, we need to be looking at Islam in a global context and not just in a regional context. In terms of the Saudis, I would say what I just said, that the Saudi Arabian nation will always remain an important nation for Muslims, not because of the population, not because of the oil, but because Mecca and Medina, the two holiest places of Islam, are in Saudi Arabia. They are so important that the king of Saudi Arabia would rather be known as the man who looks after these two houses of God than the king of Saudi Arabia. That's his official title. And of course, for Muslims, whether it's a good government or a bad government in Saudi Arabia, they will always revere and have affection for Mecca and Medina. Now, Saudis can play a critical role. They can play a very important role because there is a kind of legitimacy of authority for them. And if they were able to say, look, this is the direction we need to take, we need to revive our own traditions of tolerance, of acceptance, of compassion, we need to read our own great mystic figures, we need to discover how to be able to live with the rest of the world as the modernists have been wanting, it could have a major impact on the Muslim world, especially the rural and the uneducated and the tribal people. But that is not happening, and therefore, that third model of Islam, that is the literalist, fundamentalist model, will continue to go along its own merry path.
So, you, as an advisor to leaders, what are you advising? We know what you're advising the United States, and that's clear, of course, and that's very important. But what would you advise the Muslim leaders on what to do in their own countries and how to allow...
The problem may be the United States, but it is much more a problem for the Muslim leaders because it is their problem primarily. Mm-hmm. On 9/11, the people who came from the Muslim world were not Americans. They were coming from the Muslim world. Osama bin Laden is not from America. He's from the Muslim world. So it is really a Muslim problem. To Muslim leaders, I very clearly, every time I talk, write on television, I say that they must provide their own peoples some justice. They must give them some hope. They must give them education. They must give them health schemes and social schemes and housing schemes, because people in the Muslim world in Cairo, in Karachi, in Kuala Lumpur are living in shanty towns without much hope, and there's a lot of anger because they also see a lot of wealth in the elite, and they see the gap between the very rich and the very poor. This gap they see as increasing, and that doesn't help the mood in the Muslim world. And therefore, I appeal to the Muslim leaders that they must be truer to their own history and their own culture. Unfortunately, they don't read very much. Unfortunately, they don't exhibit much wisdom, very little vision, and therefore their only aim is to hold on to power. And they do this by coming to Washington and saying, either you support us, or the fanatics will take over. So Washington, looking for simple answers, simple solutions,
yes,
tends to support the dictators and those who come to them to promise them loyalty and total commitment to the war on terror.
So, what you know, the question that the West asks, where are the moderates in the Muslim world? I think what you've been saying so far explains where the moderates are. And that's the best explanation I've ever heard about where the moderates are.
Thank you so much. That's a great compliment. You know, I get this question all the time. Well, you're a moderate. Why can't there be more people like you? And I say, I don't know what world you're living in. Benazir Bhutto, a former Prime Minister of Pakistan, didn't just ask the question like you sitting here in the comfort of the United States,
yeah,
which she could have done. She actually packed up and went home knowing that she'd be blown up, mm-hmm, and gave her life for democracy. Now, she may have been a corrupt politician, she may have been a bad politician, an incompetent politician, but she believed in democracy. So Muslims, the moderate Muslims, are out there, they're fighting, they're giving their lives, and in the elections, and here's the proof for you, in the last election a few months ago in Pakistan, who did people vote for? Did they vote for the mullahs, the religious parties, or the moderates? The people overwhelmingly swept in the moderate parties, the PPP and the Muslim League. And the religious parties, who had 66 seats in parliament, this time have 6 seats.
Wow.
So they were reduced from 66 to 6. And when did they get 66? They got 66 when Musharraf was in complete command and control. So obviously there's something going on which escapes the eye here in Washington. And we need to be more alert to what's going on in the Muslim world and not look for simplistic analysis and simplistic answers.
Unfortunately, the opposite is happening in the GCC area and the Arab world. The Muslims are sweeping all the seats. The extremists are sweeping all the seats in parliament from Kuwait to other places in the Middle East.
Well, it's a trend I'm talking about. It could happen in Pakistan. If these people fail, and they are failing again, there's a lot of infighting. You're reading the news. There's a lot of political tension in Pakistan right now. And if they fail, then who's going to benefit? It'll be the mullahs.
Wow. I never asked you this question. What about the role of women in the Muslim world?
The role of women in the Muslim world is a very clear one, and it's, for me, the most hopeful one. Muslim men have not given the rights that women deserve. They have tried to keep the rights from them. They've used Islam to prevent these rights, especially tribal people, especially rural people. But women in Islam are perhaps the most active, the most vigorous part of the population. You will see an amazing awakening in women in Islam. I have come across hundreds of editors and ambassadors and Benazir Bhutto was the first female prime minister in the Muslim world. There's a female prime minister in Bangladesh. There's a female president in Indonesia. So women in Islam are conscious that Islam gives them more rights than any other religion in the world, that those rights have been taken away and they're going to fight for them and reclaim those rights. So I'm quite confident that sooner or later they will get there. It's going to be a tough battle for them. It will not be helped at all by American interventions and the perception of Islam under attack, because that intervention does not help them at all. That only helps the fundamentalists who will not give women their rights. So this complicated relationship that I'm constantly referring to also affects women in Islam.
Our friend Jean Houston says, like the industrial age, this is the age of Muslim women, and they will be the connectors between the two worlds.
Which friend of yours says that?
Dr. Jean Houston.
Yes, Dr. Jean Houston is quite right.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to open the floor for a few questions, if you allow us.
Yes, please.
Anyone? Questions? Yes.
Really enjoyed what you have to say. It's very enlightening.
Introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Bruce Gibb.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you.
I'm curious about whether there may be some silver lining to what's happening with regards to the tribal areas. Are the Taliban in some ways uniting, bringing together under one roof these groups which have been antagonistic to each other over time, and maybe over time they will become more moderated, or the Taliban would become more moderated. What's your view of that?
Bruce, I've written a whole book on my days in Waziristan. If you are interested in that part of the world, and you should be, it's a very important part of the world. It's called Resistance and Control in Pakistan. And it's based on my experiences in Waziristan. Now, in answer to your question, unless the government of Pakistan, along with the United States, which has an immediate interest and concern about that area, unless they have a long-term strategy whereby they can contain the Taliban, revive local leadership, revive local customs and institutions like the Jirga, and thereby check the power of the Taliban, and institute educational reforms so the young generation is not lost. Unless that happens, I'm afraid I don't see much hope. And forget the tribal areas. Bruce, you should be worried about Afghanistan, because you're on the verge of losing that country. And if you lose Afghanistan, you might as well pack up and start coming home, because there won't be much left to hold on to in that part of the world.
Thank you.
Dr. Ahmed, my name is James Carroll. Thank you very much for your presentation. My question was to backtrack a little bit. Do you feel that then none of the mystic tradition has any real opportunity to influence the conversation today in Islam?
You see, the problem with the mystic tradition is this. It is genuinely rooted in the idea of nonviolence. It genuinely is. It believes in compassion. It sees everything as one. I believe very much in the same tradition as Rumi. Now, Rumi says, Rumi is a great mystic, very popular in the United States. Rumi says, I go to the synagogue, I go to the church, I go to the mosque, and I see the same spirit and the same altar. Now, that is the spirit of the mystic. Jesus is the embodiment of the mystic spirit of love and humility and compassion in Islam. What did humanity do to Jesus? They put him up on the cross. How could he resist them? Could he resist two soldiers of the Roman army? He couldn't. That is the mystic. That's the dilemma of the mystic. So when a mystic turns up and someone shoots at him, and there are a lot of Muslims who believe that mystics are selling out, that they compromise Islam, that when they say we are all the same, we all love each other, that somehow that's wandering from the straight path of Islam. We were asked the question of about the Saudi Arabs. Now, the Saudis have their own brand of Islam called Wahhabism, and that's a very hard, straightforward, literalist, fundamentalist kind of Islam which abhors and rejects Sufism. So in that context, the mystic Sufi that holds sway traditionally, and believe me, I know the Muslim world, there are millions and millions and millions of Muslims who are deeply, deeply and devout Sufis. But in this environment of violence and killing and counter-killing, they have no say, because if they venture out of their homes, they'll be killed. They'll be the first victims. And I see their plight on this journey of mine. I talk to many of them, and they would initially they wouldn't come out. They would be sort of in the closet, if you like, and after a couple of hours, I'd suddenly begin to feel, my God, I'm sitting in the presence of a mystic, and I'd understand why.
You've answered my question better than I hoped. Thank you. I think I was just wanting to know if there was still at least sort of an underground, allegiance to the mystic tradition.
Oh, yes, there very much is. Have a look at this book of mine, Journey into Islam. I actually describe meeting some remarkable mystics along the journey. I go to the greatest mystic shrine in South Asia, and there are thousands of people who turn up and the interaction there, and I have my American students with me, and the response of the American students to what they were seeing.
Rumi, Hafiz, and all the mystics are forbidden. Their books are forbidden in the Middle East, so I have to sneak out a few books here and there and put a different cover usually for my friends in the Middle East.
Well, my dear, I'm delighted that I've joined their company, because I believe mine are prohibited in one or two countries. That's my only hope, my only claim to fame.
As you know, we have a special interest in the Palestine-Israel dynamic. Are you seeing any kind of movement as the conversation between Israel and Syria serious? You see any major attempt in Palestine to shift away from Hamas to Fatah?
Again, I wouldn't see it so much in terms of Hamas and Fatah. I would see it in terms of resolving the basic issue. Unless you resolve the issue, these are just words, whether it's Fatah, whether it's Hamas. The basic issue will remain, and that is the issue of Palestinian nationhood that has to be resolved. And if the Israelis are talking to the Syrians, I am pleased, because it means some movement. Because I have been quite despondent. Judea Pearl, the father of Danny Pearl, and I conduct these Jewish-Muslim dialogues throughout the United States and in Canada and Europe and so on. And the last time, a couple of weeks ago, I asked Judea on stage. These are very widely attended sessions. We have usually over 1,000 people and television and the media and so on, because Judea is a very well-known name. And I asked Judea about the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And he really was very, very dejected and despondent. He said, "I see no hope." And I said, "Judea, what do you see 10 years from now?" And he said, "I don't see much hope." So I would really say that it's a pretty bleak picture. And the reason is because the Israelis and the Palestinians are not sitting down and not talking in terms of human beings, ordinary human beings living, breathing, feeling pain, feeling happiness, who have to live together as neighbors. They're seeing each other as potential terrorists, potential enemies, potential negotiators, so that they're sitting there and saying, "All right, we go into this negotiating cycle and do a tit for tat. I give you this little stone, you give me that little stone. If you kill one of mine, I'll kill two of yours. You kill six of mine, I kill 10 of yours. You throw in a rocket into my area, I'll come and blow up 300 apartment flats of yours." That is the cycle, and that is the mentality in which they're both locked. And as long as that takes place, let me tell you how I see it from the Muslim world. This is what I see. I see a lot of hatred. I see a lot of anti-Semitism. I hear talk of wiping out and exterminating Israel, which disturbs me and worries me a great deal, because we are moving into an era of nuclear bombs. We are moving into an era when at least half a dozen Middle East countries in the next 10 years, whether you try to stop them by force or not, will have nuclear bombs. Iran already wants one, and it will have one in 5 years, 10 years, whenever. Egypt wants one, Turkey wants one, the UAE, Saudi Arabia. How long are we going to keep this dam from bursting? And if that happens, then look at the map of Israel, a tiny state surrounded by 300-400 million Arabs who are quite hostile to it. And by the middle of the century, their numbers will double. So therefore, I believe that if we want to help resolve the issue, we need to very seriously, and I mean this seriously, I don't mean this kind of window dressing that we get from time to time, that we have these wonderful international conferences which result in nothing, zero. And we come back to Hamas said this, Fatah said this. We need to resolve the issue of the Palestinian statehood so that the two states live together in security, in harmony and peace, and guaranteed by the world that you two have your states, both of you get on with each other, at least don't shoot at each other, or we will not tolerate it. If that happens overnight, I believe the Palestinians, who are a sophisticated people, educated people, they're an ambitious, hardworking people, they themselves will choose leaders. They themselves will say, "We want to get on in economic terms, we want to have a thriving, economically viable state," and they will be the best partners with Israel. This is what we should be encouraging both to be doing.
Absolutely, and that's the basis of our initiative in Palestine.
I applaud you for that.
Well, thank you. It is amazing to me to see extremists in the Philippines and Indonesia claim that they're fighting for Palestine. So this is what I think our administration needs to understand, especially Israel. The Israeli government needs to understand.
You shouldn't be amazed by this, because I traveled, not now, I've done this recently, but in 92, I traveled for a BBC series which I was asked to host called Living Islam, a six-part television series. So we went throughout the Muslim world. We traveled from West Africa, Morocco, right through the Middle East, Indonesia, Central Asia. And do you know, wherever I went, when I talked to Muslims or visited their offices, they would have the replica of the Jerusalem mosque on their table, or an image or a picture.
Wow.
Jerusalem is very evocative for Muslims, and therefore the Palestinian issue will not be forgotten by the Muslim world, and therefore it's not just a Palestinian-Israeli issue and Hamas and Fatah, it's really a global issue, and we all need to help resolve it, because this tiny, tiny, tiny part of the world is so important for everyone that it has diverted all our energies, all our resources, including the resources of the superpower of the world, into trying to resolve something that is not being resolved.
Absolutely. We took a lot of your time, but tell us a little bit about your travels. What are you going to be doing in the next few months?
I'm going to be traveling from the fall. We've divided the United States into 10 zones, so we'll be traveling throughout the length and breadth. We will be talking to community leaders, religious leaders, to evangelists, to rabbis, to students. And I want to build up a picture of, through the Muslim community, what is the Muslim community, what does it look like, what is it reading, who are its role models. I want to talk to non-Muslims about what they think of Muslims, what the problems are, if they see any problems, how could things improve between them, what bridges could be built, and so on.
So this will be posted on your website?
Yes, BeliefNet. We had 2 weeks ago, Judea Pearl and I did a two-week conversation on BeliefNet. If you go on BeliefNet, you'll see it's still there, very popular dialogue we had with everyone. And we'll have do a similar thing for this journey. It's called Journey into America.
Oh, that's one. We'll definitely link for it from our website.
Yes, and we are doing a lot of reading on America and American culture and American history, and I'm really enjoying it because I'm discovering so much about this great country, and it really is an amazing country. If you have to read anything, go back and read de Tocqueville, who wrote in the 1830s, and he wrote this amazing book on America when American society is just forming, and all the great virtues and the institutions of American society, the respect for democracy, for human rights, for civil liberties. All this is forming when de Tocqueville is looking at and commenting on American society.
I've got one more question for you, dear friend. Did you see Mr. Wilson's war movie?
Of course I did, and when I saw it, you know what I asked myself?
What's
I said,
that?
Where are the Wilsons of the United States today? Where is Charlie Wilson? Wheel him out.
All right. Any other comment or question from anybody?
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure, and good luck in the important work you're doing.
Okay,
and let's remain
you.
In touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry.